Welcome back to part two of our discussion on grief with Irene Parrott. Welcome back, Irene. So at the beginning of the last episode,
I sort of mentioned that I considered grief to be related to loss. So something's lost, it's irretrievable. But I thought a bit when I was writing about grief in relation to memorial tattoos, to companion animals, I started to think more about this idea of continuing bonds. So it's sort of well researched in the as a form of grief work. So this idea of continuing bonds is it doesn't end. There isn't a loss. It's just a transformative process. So the person is no longer living and present, but the relationship continues. And there's been a few papers, Wendy Packman and a few others have published on this idea of continuing bonds with companion animals and how it can sort of help with the transformative process of grieving. So you're not sort of forgetting about them, they're ever present, and there's ways of doing this. It can be sort of a piece of jewelry or a tattoo or a memorial, or even this idea of setting up a fund in that name, so sort of a campaign. And I think we see a lot of that with environmentalism and other ways of sort of keeping the memory alive. So for example, the cause of their death, sort of set up a fund in that name, so you're constantly working with, and the relationship has changed. So I wonder if that is actually this continuing bond, it's sort of a way maybe of avoiding grief, I don't know, or a way of working. It's sort of in the literature, it's discussed as part of grief work, and it's not about sort of get over it, move on, and the stages of grief and the sort of old way that you went through these stages and then you moved on. But this idea of continuing bonds is you don't move on, the relationship just changes, and the memories and the relationship to that person who is no longer physically present.
Doesn't that bring up that essentially, you know, the reason there aren't specific stages are grief is so very personal, and the experience and the grief work is so very personal, that what works for one person might not work for someone else. I know people who hang on to their loved ones, human or other species, ashes for years and years. And then there are others who want to scatter them. There are some that keep, you know, a collar or keep a necklace, photograph. And then for others, that's, you know, too painful. You know, I keep my collars from my little fluffy soulmates that I've lost. But for other people, that's too much. So I think that's part of it. It's just that this entire grief process is so very, very intimate and personal, that even though we all share the experience, the way that we go through it is so very different that it's almost impossible to understand how someone else is feeling.
And if we can't understand each other as humans, how can we understand what other species are going through, and how to help them versus be the opposite of helping?
You know, that brings up the research about complicated grief, that if an individual is not allowed to deal with their own process, that this becomes this complicated grief, which can have long-lasting repercussions for the individual throughout the rest of their life.
So I guess it could be argued either way, whether somebody's hanging on to their grief and it's seemed as unacceptable for people to be hanging on. It could be argued either way, whether somebody's taking too long or too short a time to grieve. It could be argued absolutely either way, because it's society that's judging us in the cultures that we live in. And one of the links I found, which we can put in the references, and it's only a very short like blog link, actually had some interesting comparisons of how it's acceptable to grieve in different cultures. The length of time could either be very short or very long, and it can be quiet or it can be loud, and it can be public or it can be private. There are different rituals and practices of what to wear and what to put out and what's expected of you. And I'm sure we can think of different examples. And of course, there's official periods of mourning for some deaths within society. But this whole idea of length of time is something that I think we judge ourselves as well when we experience a loss. How long is it acceptable to talk to my friends about it? How long is it acceptable to bring it up again to my partner? And I think this is really interesting, where these different spaces, the deathscapes, which are spaces dedicated to mourning, are often public spaces. But when people are finding their grief is disenfranchised or oppressed or not allowed or criminalized, all of these oppressive forces that prevent us or more than human animals expressing their grief. For humans, at least, they can go to online spaces now where there are specific spaces on social media or in forums where people can talk anonymously about the grief they have and try and work through their feelings there. And I think that's really important in today's society. I utilised one of those spaces when my cats died. It's really interesting that people are able to turn to that, something that more than human animals are obviously unable to do.
We put a lot of pressure on ourselves because of expectations. And I wonder if that is something that we struggle with even more than societal pressures. Societal pressures will influence us, but then we want to fit in to certain remits. And these internal pressures we put on, sometimes may be imaginary. And I think that they are very hard to work through. And certainly having space to do it is helpful. But again, different things work at different times, don't they? And you have to be ready to work through particular feelings. And sometimes you have to compartmentalize those feelings. You're not ready to work through them yet. And they sit there until you are. And that, I think, having the opportunity to visit those, it's hard, but it's sometimes necessary to be able to move your grieving process forward.
Yeah, and I think that's where the idea of continuing bonds is really, really helpful. So part of the problem is with society is society in general is very uncomfortable with death. And I think if you're mourning, it's like I have a couple of tattoos of my cats and people are like, is that your cat? And usually I just say yes, because I say like, yeah, she's dead now. Then it becomes sort of, then they feel bad. And I don't want people to feel bad because I don't feel bad. It's not something that should bring people down. And this came out quite a bit in my research on memorial tattoos, that they were for the wearer something positive, but often questions sort of, yeah, is that your cat? They kind of learn to say yes and just leave it at that. But yeah, so I was actually thinking when you were talking earlier, when does grief end and it becomes something else? This idea. So the old school was that you should get over it and then nobody talked about death. And I guess that's sort of, yeah, so grieving is bad and it needs to end, but does it? And I kind of see it more as a process and this sort of transformative thing. And I'm waffling on, but my point I wanted to make, and this has come out with people who have memorial tattoos dedicated to humans as well as other than human animals. And this came out in my research. One of my participants had a tattoo of her dog. This dog was a childhood companion. And even now, so she has had a history of self-abuse. And if she gets that urge, she sort of puts her hand on the tattoo. She realizes then like her dog wouldn't want her to do that. And there's been a couple of other examples in the literature with one woman with her father. She had something similar in memory of her father that also helped to combat the urge to self-abuse. So you're kind of relating to that person who has gone, but they haven't really gone because their memory's there. And it's sort of using that intermediary sort of device. And I guess that's where a lot of rituals and things they come from as useful tools to be able to relate back to the person who's not physically present. But yeah, so I wonder when does grief become a bad thing? I guess when it's suppressed or disenfranchised. Otherwise it's, but yeah, when does grief become memory? Is there a term for that, memory?
I'm not sure grief is ever complete. Because we grieve for different beings. So we add to our grief. So it's an ongoing process that we're going through, and it's cumulative, isn't it? When we grieve for a particular passing, that adds to the feelings of grief that we've had previously, and that's probably something we're going to go through throughout our lives, but probably at different levels. So the grieving is still there, but we have times in our life when we feel it less and times in our life that we feel it more. But I know there's different schools of thought on whether grief is complete. But to me, it's you don't forget who you've grieved for before just because you've lost someone more recently. And in fact, it gives you the opportunity to reflect very often, which is bittersweet, isn't it? But in a way, I think having that opportunity, giving ourselves permission to reflect, is quite valuable. And it helps with that transformative process that we're all going through the process of grief. Something else I was thinking about was anticipatory grief, the two sides of the coin with anticipatory grief, and how that can help us prepare for what we know is coming, but maybe help us be more proactive through the process of grief. So to bring something positive within the loss.
I absolutely agree with you, at least from my own perspective, because it gives you time to adjust, to think, to, you know, it might bring fear. It depends what loss is going to occur, what relationship is going to end, but at least it gives you some time to adjust and for maybe both parties to adjust. But one of the anticipatory losses, which is linked in with criminalized grief, I was looking up the COVID, the lockdown, the practices and rituals that were, I'm talking UK specific here, but I know there are more countries that were affected, and people who lost, talk specifically about people here, and were unable to go to funerals. They were unable to be involved in many of the normal rituals and practices. And that kind of grief, even though it might have been anticipatory, is now combined with this criminalized element of grief, because it was criminal at the time, it was against the law. And that must be very difficult for people to work through and very unusual. And in terms of humans losing more than human animals, specifically companion animals, and the companion animals losing their human guardians, people had great difficulty in taking their companion animals to the vets. They might have been suddenly ill, terminally ill, chronically ill. And euthanasia, lots of people, especially in these online spaces, talked about how they were unable to see their friend and end the relationship in the way that they wanted to end the relationship. And I couldn't find any articles on it. I did have a look, but I couldn't see it was written about at all. It'd be really interesting if anybody can find any. But that must have affected people in having those combined grief processes put upon people and more than human animals. It must have been absolutely dreadful. And I don't know how you work through that, because it's probably such a unique situation. And maybe at the same time, it's disenfranchised again.
And the lack of control as well, which is a big thing, isn't it? So that adds to your guilt. And I think the lack of control people were able to have at that time, and at such a vital time in your relationship, it's very, very difficult if you've lost that control to be able to help the animal pass as peacefully as possible, because you just don't know. In many cases, we weren't there. So it complicates how you're feeling. And it may be certainly when animals who live with me have been euthanized, I feel very differently when they've been able to pass peacefully, or they've had a natural death and they've passed peacefully, to when things haven't been peaceful. And you walk away with a totally different set of emotions. So they sit with you differently. And again, it's that transformative process, isn't it? And how they sit with you, and how do you resolve those feelings? You ever resolve those feelings?
I think goes back to what Sarah said about control too, is just that during COVID, when we were all on lockdown, we had no control over anything, right? How we were working and where we were working and who we were seeing. And I think that there was already a lot of mental stress and mental anxiety and increased, you know, mental health problems. And then to pile on top of that grief, especially unexpected grief, was just too much for a lot of people. I mean, I think a lot of people emerged from COVID very broken.
One of the other questions I've got about grief in terms of human grief and more than human animal grief is words. I was wondering, Michelle, if you'd thought of any power words that are used to control situations, minimize people's grief, amplify people's grief, etc.
I think that probably the word only that you mentioned earlier, right? That it was only an animal, or it was, you know, only your second cousin. It was someone I knew a long time ago. So it was only an old friend. I didn't ever see them anymore. You know, we try to quantify that. But I can offer an example of the opposite, how I have used language to be allowed to express my grief, in that when I used to lose, you know, the elephants I work with are clearly not in ideal situations, right? And so loss is very much a part of my life. And when I would lose a friend in Nepal, an elephant friend, and I would talk about that at work or with friends, there was a lot of misunderstanding. I wasn't allowed to grieve, right? It was disenfranchised grief. And so what I started doing is simply referring to everyone I dealt with in Nepal as a research participant, right? And so when one of my research participants had a bad injury, I would just say, oh yes, I'm feeling down today because my research participant was injured. Oh, I lost a research participant that I've known for the last 10 years. You know, she passed the last week, or, and suddenly I was allowed to discuss it. You know, people were, oh my gosh, you know, that's terrible. You know, how long have you known her? What was her name? And I would tell them, and we would have this discussion, and they would have no idea that I was talking about an elephant. And that allowed me to publicly work through this grief without being shut down. So, I mean, in a way, learning to control the narrative so that you are not forced into that disenfranchised grief is maybe equally important, you know, and I wonder if that helps with, you know, Chris, can she talk about her friend Sophie, or, you know, her, can you discuss it in that way? Would there be more acceptance? And maybe that would also, you know, sort of keep us from saying what kind of grief is allowed.
It's a really interesting concept, actually. It'd be a great project to look at something like that. One of the things that made me think of words used is the author who wrote, "Sorry for the loss of your little friend, grievability and condolence cards for humans mourning animals." They talk about how the word little friend, you wouldn't use it in such a way if you were talking about a human person that had been lost. But one of the things that they talk about is, they go on from there talking about how they find the cards are mainly for cat and dog owners, and there are some for horses, gerbils, rats, birds and fishes. And it made me go back to thinking about this idea of grievable lives. Would you be able to write a card for the loss of an elephant, for the loss of a shark, in our research worlds? What about if you gave somebody condolences for the loss of a food animal? You'd be laughed at, you know, or you'd be seen as taking the mick. You know, if you wrote condolence cards for people after Christmas or after Easter or after any other religious festival or any other festival that uses, or even after any kind of meal, it's like, and the person who's talking about the annihilation, as they describe it, of the 17 million mink in Denmark after because of COVID-19. How do you write and who do you write to give condolences to about the loss of those animals? I don't know, it just got me thinking, really. It's just a comment. I just wondered what you guys thought of that.
Dear planet Earth, we're sorry.
The card is not for the person that is lost. It's not for the more than human animal that is lost. It's, we do that in a completely different way, which I know is, I'm kind of going off track here a bit.
Yeah, what I mean, yeah, so the condolences, it's for the person that's grieving. But yeah, going back to other than human animals, and I mean, yeah, so like you were saying, Michelle, we know a lot about how elephants grieve in their natural environment, so that can potentially be used to, I don't know, help them. And I actually find it fascinating that this is sort of a thing even to research, that it almost seems like, duh, that we know dogs grieve. It's, I guess everybody has anecdotal examples of when, for example, their grandfather died and the dog would sit on his chair for months. And we kind of already know that, especially with dogs. But yeah, I wonder how, I guess what I'm really thinking is sort of thing now where it's recommended or suggested, if possible, to show the dead body to the
other companion animals, so sort of bonded pairs of cats, dogs, animals that have lived close together. And I mean, I did feel a bit guilty that I couldn't do that with Yoda. She didn't sort of know that Sophie had died. But then I'm thinking, so as a species, cats do tend to go off and die by themselves. That's sort of a cat thing. That maybe that's, maybe, yeah, I don't know. It's sort of a very anthropocentric idea that you need to see the dead body, because that's what humans tend to need, is sort of closure, and seeing the physical body helps. And we maybe we overassume that other animals need that too. And maybe they're better off thinking, oh, they've gone off to die, or they've gone off, they're going to come back, and then they don't come back. And it's, yeah, I don't know. I wonder if you have any insight into that, Irene, from what you've looked at so far.
Again, it I think it's individual. I think different individuals will respond differently. So some will show interest or more in the body of a dead cohort, and others will prefer not to. But aren't we the same as humans?
Yeah.
You know, so it may depend on the strength of the relationship. But even cross species, you still see these strong ties, and you still see these bonds that have become broken through death, and there appears to be a recognition of that from the animal who's left. So I must admit, if one of my animals dies, I give the other animals in our social group the opportunity to see the body, touch the body, smell, if they wish to. And some do and some don't. And it's entirely, you know, it's entirely up to them which they choose to do.
There's a book I just wanted to mention called Enter the Animal, Cross Species Perspectives on Grief and Spirituality. We'll put the link in the references for this podcast. But they talk a lot about the different species that do exhibit affective behavior, since we can't say mourning or grieving, right? That exhibit affective behavior at the death of conspecifics or other family members, focuses on, you know, the spirituality and the mourning of other species. So I think that's a really good one to check out if you haven't yet.
Yeah, I think Barbara King too has written about animals grieving.
I think Eva Meyer has done some work as well, hasn't she?
But yeah, just I guess to finish off thinking about how we could navigate this as researchers. And I guess in a way it's kind of a disenfranchised grief, is I don't know, as researchers, how close, it's always an ongoing thing, how close should we be to our research participants, interlockers, and that sort of blurred boundaries. And of course, yeah, we grieve. I wonder if we think enough about the other than human animals potentially grieving us when we leave them, especially if we spend a lot of time in the field with them and then suddenly we go home and write about them. I don't know, I'm just throwing it out there. If it's probably been thought about a lot more with human-human relationships. And
I was just gonna say, with our human participants, we at least can stay in contact with them.
Exactly.
Via email and Facebook. And I made a comment in one of my papers about relying upon the humans that live in the area to maintain my connection with some of the other species, just because the other species clearly do not have a Facebook account. So yeah, we are very reliant when it comes to keeping in touch with our research participants on humans. Again, the elephants I work with are not in good situations, and neither are the humans. So when I leave, I have a sense of loss, and I grieve their situation. I grieve them being stuck in a situation that I can do nothing about. That's just it. You know, I try to do what I can, but...
But I think you're right, Chris. If there are these relationships that are developed between researchers and more than human animals, let's say specifically in laboratory situations or captive situations, then yeah, I would say, like you said before, it seems obvious to us. Of course, the animal is going to grieve, but I think we've talked about before on podcasts, not everybody's the same. Different people have got different levels of empathy, different levels of emotional knowledge, different levels of an ability to understand or even recognize that even other humans are dealing with stuff. Psychology goes into the whole world of sociopathy and psychopathy. And I think that maybe some people just don't have the connection and therefore don't grieve. the loss of the relationship and don't even think about the loss that the more than human animal may have when the researcher steps away.
Could it be protective though as well, like we talked about earlier? I mean, maybe the only way to get your research done is to acknowledge, I mean, and I'm thinking in terms of fostering human children, right? The only way that you can get the job done is knowing that you're going to have to leave, or that that child is going to move on, or, you know, that, you know, if you're talking about fostering dogs and cats, that that animal is going to move on. I mean, maybe that's part of it, is being able to compartmentalize everything.
Totally agree, but I don't think that everybody's the same. I still don't think that everybody's got the same ability, and I don't think everybody has the same intentions. And society doesn't make us question these intentions that we have when we go into research. I mean, even in our ethics applications, we're not asked, how are you going to compensate for the lack of relationship that will exist after you leave the more than human animal? I mean, that's not asked at all. So we're not expected to even think about it. So, but I agree, some people obviously do. I mean, you definitely do, but I think some people definitely won't. I don't know what anybody else thinks about that.
I think it's the same people with people who volunteer, who do this volunteerism thing and go work in orphanages, or go, you know, they take into account, oh, I'm going to go help these humans, and then they don't think about the what happens when you're gone, right? So now the kids have someone new, they have attention, they have support, and it only lasts a week, you know. And the same with foster care. When we were doing human foster care, we had the same thoughts. Is it better to never have known this better situation existed, or is it better to have a little bit of relief and then go back? You know, we think about the person doing the mm-hmm. fostering or the caring or the work in the orphanage. We don't think about the recipients and how what happens to them when we leave. Well, I wonder if that goes, I'm thinking back to when we talked to Ken Shapiro on the last episode about scholar advocacy, right? And maybe that's why scholar advocacy is so important, because when you become involved in the lives of your research participants, that there is a sort of obligation there, right? You no longer have the choice to walk away, right? You need to realize the ethical significance of all of your participants and try in some way to, you know, spread knowledge and improve what needs improving.
And that could include the role of narrative, couldn't it? So, you know, we could be looking at other ways of identifying the individual and forefronting the individual through different mediums, so that it is easier to recognize. And though our levels of empathy may differ depending on life circumstances and who we are and our personalities and so on and so forth, sometimes just that first step, and maybe that narrative and identifying the individual for who they are rather than what they are, is a way of helping with that.
I think so. And I mean, I included biographies in my, when I did my PhD, I included several elephant biographies for that reason, you know, trying to personalize that. You know, I talked a lot about, you know, this mahout or that mahout, but I also very specifically wanted to tell the story of the elephant lives as well, too, because I had the power to do that, right? I don't have the power to go live somewhere and run a sanctuary and do this, but what I do have is the ability to write these things. So I think, you know, in my way, yeah, that's my witnessing.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, Irene. Yeah, there's a lot more to talk about in terms of grief. So maybe you can come back another time and carry on some of these discussions. Join us next time on the Anthropozoology podcast.